Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week's rain was welcomed in the White Mountains, where an unusually persistent forest fire has caused trouble this fall. Although wildfires in New Hampshire don't come close to the epic blazes that occur out west, this season's dry conditions have kept firefighters busy and led to the closure of several popular trails. Today in The Exchange, predicting and preventing forest fires. And let's hear from you, your questions and comments about what we've seen in New Hampshire and what you're seeing on the news out west. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests in studio. Will Abbott is here, Vice President for Policy and Stewardship at the Forest Society. And Will, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Brad Simpkins, State Forester and Director of the New Hampshire Division of Forests and Lands. And Brad, welcome. Good to have you too.
Thank you.
And also with us, Heidi Asbjornsen. She's an Associate Professor of Ecosystem Ecology at UNH. Heidi and her team have been studying how trees handle drought. And Heidi, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, and all of you, let's start with John McKay. He's the fire chief in Woodstock, where this stubborn fire called the Dilley Cliffs Fire is located. And Chief McKay, welcome.
Good morning.
So Dilley Cliffs, for those who aren't familiar with your part of the state, where is that exactly and when did this fire start?
It's on Lost River Road, Route 112 in North Woodstock. Started on October 3rd, on Tuesday morning at 6:20 a.m. is when we got the call.
Wow. And what clues do you have, Chief, about how this fire got started?
It's still questionable how it started. My prediction is either a campfire or a cigarette is my thought, but it is no determined yet.
Wow. And yeah, from what I understand, that's a common source of forest fires here in New Hampshire. So not a lightning strike and not a meteor. There was some speculation that a meteor might have hit.
No, we haven't found no meteor yet.
So okay.
I would say it's human caused.
Has it been mostly smoke, Chief, or has there also been a lot of flames?
Oh, been a lot of flames. You know, the first 2 days was just incredible, and especially at nighttime, it just takes off. It took off. Usually at nighttime, it calms down because of you know, humidity and stuff like that changes at night. But the first two nights, it just took off and exploded. It was just incredible.
Wow. Yeah, and we put some pictures up on our website, so folks can check that out, nhpr.org/exchange. Why has this fire been so hard to put out, Chief McKay?
The terrain, mostly. It's steep, it's rocky. There's been, you know, rock slides over many years, and it just made little caverns, and it just, the fire got down in them, and you're just unable to put them out, and just stubborn.
Well, and so what's the difference between containing and putting out a fire? Because sometimes on the news we hear, you know, the fire is 10% contained or 80% contained. What's the difference?
Containing it to where the firemen can... Oh, usually put it could be a road, it could be a river. You put a line around the fire so it cannot spread. So containment is, you know, the line you put around the fire. When you say 5%, you know, it may just be one section of the fire that has a line around it. But that's containment. And then putting it out is you know, it's done. There's no more smoke. There's no more fire.
So has this Dilley Cliffs fire been contained?
Yes. Yes, it has, and with this rain the last 2 days, I'd say it's, well, probably 90% put out. I'm sure there's still going to be a few hot spots here and there that we'll have to wait till snow to get to. But Yeah, we definitely rain helped.
Now that's interesting because, and good news to hear that it's almost 90% put out, not just contained. Can you explain to me, Chief, please, what hot spots are? And I think in that explanation, you might use a word that I just learned a couple days ago, duff. So what are hot spots?
Hot spots are like there is like could be a big fuel load of, you know, branches, stumps, old logs. You know, the fire gets in them and just keeps burning. Those are the hot spots. Other stuff, you know, it might just be leaf litter and it'll just burn the leaf litter off and then it's gone. But then you get into this heavy fuel load and it just keeps burning. And you really got to get in and work with water and hand tools to separate the materials and work it with your hands and put it out.
So that's interesting. So putting out fires isn't just about, you know, blasting it with a hose. You have to use equipment to yank it apart. Yeah, go ahead. Give us a little more there.
Yeah, it's definitely you know, Pulaski, shovels, and it's a matter of, you know, one guy running the hose and several guys, you know, digging it out. And it just burns so deep into the duff, which is, you know, it's pine needles, leaves just that have rotted over the years. And it gets in there and just it is tough to put out.
How long are you going to be monitoring this area? I know you said it's in pretty good shape now, but how long are you going to be keeping an eye on it?
Oh, over the next couple of weeks. I'd say, you know, some of it, we're going to be waiting until snow. It's just, even with this rain, it just gets down in those rocks and stumps and you just can't get to them. So it'll be several weeks before we hopefully don't see any smoke at all.
Wow, you're going to wait until snow until you feel better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would say so on this one. It's tough.
Well, good luck to you, Chief McKay. It's been good to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. That's John McKay. He's the fire chief in Woodstock. Again, talking about the recent Dilley Cliffs fire near Lost River Gorge. We're going to bring someone else in who also has been dealing with this situation and who has worked on forest fires for a long time. Joe Koloski is on the line, acting deputy forest supervisor at the White Mountain National Forest. And Joe, thank you also for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, when this Dilley Cliffs fire was, you know, burning pretty heavily, as the chief told us, who came in to help? As from what I understand, it was a local, state, and national response.
Right, it was, Laura. And initially, local Forest Service crews from the White Mountain National Forest responded initially. But over time, as the fire continued to burn and we needed additional resources, we reached out beyond the White Mountain.
And beyond the White Mountain, so where did that come from?
We actually brought in crews from the upper Midwest. We had fire personnel from there and also a crew from South Carolina.
Wow. How are those decisions made, Joe? I've always been curious about that because you hear headlines about, you know, 20 firefighters from New Hampshire went out west or, you know, like you just said, firefighters from the Midwest came here. How is it decided that these people will go out and help elsewhere and these people will stay home to keep an eye on the threat here?
Yeah, and it's a pretty complex system that's in place. But nationally, there is a coordinating group nationally that handles wildfire dispatch and response. And it's really separated geographically. So across the United States, there are 10 geographic areas that coordinate wildfire response. And so for the White Mountain National Forest, we're in the Eastern Coordination Center. So when we have a wildfire incident or even an all-risk incident like a flood or a hurricane that needs a response of emergency personnel, the call will go out to those coordination centers from local people that are managing that incident. So in this case, we had an incident commander on scene who, you know, evaluates the fire and what the resource need is to respond to that fire, puts a call into our dispatch center with that resource need, and then that goes out into the system nationally.
How often do fires happen in the White Mountain National Forest, Joe?
Not very often. This is an area of the country that, if you look historically at data and research on fire return interval. Fire is not a real common occurrence in this area. If you look at fire return intervals for this part of the Northeast, looking at maybe 40 to 50 years between large fires returning to this area.
Oh, wow.
As compared to other parts of the country where that can be as low as, 2 to 3 years average fire return interval. So this ecosystem is not what we would consider a fire-adapted ecosystem. Fire certainly played a role in this ecosystem over time. It just wasn't one of the primary disturbance factors.
Fire return interval means basically how often you have bad fires, Joe?
Yes. So just an average of how often fire would occur on the landscape.
So one last question for you, Joe, please. From what I understand, you're working right now in the White Mountain National Forest, but you've worked elsewhere, Missouri, Alabama. As a longtime professional in the forestry field, what goes through your mind when you see the news from California?
It's devastating. And what goes through my mind is, certainly concern for the people that are impacted by it, concern for the people that are responding to those wildfires. And I think that would be my first reaction. Beyond that, I think that would be it. Just concern for the folks that are impacted and making sure that we're keeping people safe as we respond to those.
Okay. Joe, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Joe Koloski again. He's acting deputy forest supervisor at the White Mountain National Forest, talking about forest fires there and elsewhere. The number for you to join us here in the exchange with your questions and comments about forest fires, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We're looking at the forest fire recently in the White Mountains and some of the news we're hearing from elsewhere in the country. Also later, we'll talk about evolving views around fire protection and prevention. 1-800-892-6477 again is the number for you to join us. And Will Abbott, I'll turn to you first. What's the most important part of this Dilley Cliffs fire in your opinion? What's the big takeaway for you?
Well, Laura, I'd say there are a couple of takeaways. One is that the Forest Society owns this property where the fire started, and hosting on that site, we have an attraction which 60,000 people a year visit. So we were really concerned about what was going to happen to the boardwalk that goes through the Lost River Gorge and the buildings that are there.
Lots of families go there. I've been there many times, squeezing through all those little caves and walking up and down those boardwalks.
Exactly. And it was our first concern, of course, was for public safety and the safety and security of the land and the buildings and structures. But I think the other thing is, as Chief McKay described, because the location where the fire started and grew was on such steep slopes, it was really unclear, how deep the fire was. And as he described, going up there at night, I was up there two or three nights the first week of the fire, and the hillside lit up like a Christmas tree. It was amazing. And so we were really concerned about protecting the property that the public's used to visiting. We have this unique relationship, a partnership with White Mountain Attractions Association in Lincoln. They actually operate the gorge, and we had to make a really tough decision. The fire team asked us to close early. This was the week before Columbus Day weekend.
I remember. Would have had tons of families up there.
10% of our visitation is during that 10-day period around Columbus Day weekend. So it was obviously we did close early, and and it was the right thing to do, but it had an impact. But it's the concerns that the fire chief and Woodstock expressed about, the early stages of the fire, you just didn't know where it was going to spread. It actually spread onto White Mountain National Forest land. They've closed the Appalachian Trail in that immediate vicinity temporarily. And the cliffs that had its own trail, which was largely destroyed by the fire, that trail is closed permanently at the moment.
So it was big.
It was certainly not California big, but
but
it was
for us,
big.
It was big.
It was big, and it was it was a particularly challenging fire.
Well, and to you also, Brad, the question that I asked Joe at the White Mountain National Forest, how common are serious forest fires in New Hampshire? You know, most of us, myself included, see the news in other parts and go, okay, well, that's one thing I don't need to worry about.
Yeah, well, we have on average about 200 wildfires a year, and they burn on average about 400 acres.
Okay, that's a lot bigger than I expected.
Yeah, so we have a lot of fires, but the vast majority of them stay small. You know, they're a quarter, a half acre, 1 acre. The fire departments go out. They do a tremendous job in New Hampshire taking care of them. As far as serious fires, we're fortunate we don't have a lot of them, but it's really cyclical. When we get into droughts like we had last year was one of the busiest years we had had since the mid-1980s. And the year before that, 2015, was also a very busy year. So we've seen some fires, several fires over the past 2 years that have gotten over 100 acres, which, you know, that's unusual. That's a fairly large fire for us. So they do happen. On average, we have a couple hundred a year. We're fortunate, though, we don't have a lot of serious ones.
Heidi, how about the trees here in New Hampshire? How well adapted are they to forest fires, given that it's generally pretty moist here in New England?
Yeah, sure. Well, so here the beeches, birches, maples, spruce, fir, they aren't very fire adapted, a very thin bark. So they're very sensitive to fire compared to some of the ecosystems out west, like the chaparral. They actually have volatile chemicals in their leaves that cause them to burn very easily. They're fire dependent ecosystems, whereas our ecosystems here are not well adapted to fire.
Now, that's interesting. So trees out west might have thicker bark that actually protects them from fire. Here, that pretty, you know, that pretty white paper birch bark just burns right up, and then the tree itself is in danger.
Right. And certainly our oaks and pines are more fire adapted. They have thicker bark. Oaks sprout after fire, and they oftentimes occur in areas that burn more frequently in the past.
So somebody asked you, how often do you have forest fires? How big a problem is that in New Hampshire? What would you say, Heidi?
Well, as both Brad and
Will
just mentioned, they aren't very common in this area. I was also surprised to hear Brad's statistics, but of course those were small fires and they were put out fairly easily. For me, the Stille Eclipse fire is really an indication that fire risk may be increasing here in New England. Forecasts for climate change are that we will see more total rainfall, but also more prolonged periods of moisture stress and even drought, such as we saw last year. So,
yeah, that's interesting. Give us a little bit more on that. What are the climate predictions from UNH? And I know UNH has a large group of scientists working on this. What are their predictions for drought conditions, Heidi?
So as we saw last year, we do expect to see more prolonged periods of moisture stress, drought, particularly in the late summer and early fall. And that's also when we might also expect fire risk to be greater, I believe. That's when we have leaves are falling, we have a thick layer of litter on the ground. And when that dries out, then it becomes very flammable. I think the other thing we saw this year is that because we had 2 years that were quite dry, soils were drier than normal. And so a lot of the fires that occur were ground fires deep in the ground. And so those are very difficult to extinguish, and they can easily flare up when winds become strong during the day.
Oh, that's interesting. And that gets us into something maybe we'll talk about after the break. Different types of what we generally call forest fires or wildland fires. It's not always that dramatic, you know, treetop burning. There's ground fires, as the chief explained to us. There's fires that kind of get down into the rocks and the roots and so forth. So we'll pick up on that after a short break. And also, Will Abbott, I'm going to ask you about climate predictions as well. Also, we'd love to hear from you, your comments, questions, personal observations about forest fires here in New Hampshire. And if you've lived elsewhere, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter, NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477.
The creative process isn't always easy, but getting distracted can be.
It feels like you're writing, but it's the equivalent of empty calories.
If you're looking, I have to write 500 words a day, it's not on Twitter. The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, your source for the productive habits we can all benefit from, along with the guilty pleasures we can all relate to. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at forest fires and evolving views around protection, prevention, also predictions about wildfires in our future. The Exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. We welcome your questions and comments about forest fires here in the Granite State and elsewhere. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, before we go to the phones, Brad, I did want you to pick up on something that Heidi said just before the break. It's real interesting. You know, you think of forest fire and you just picture trees, you know, in flames, maybe billowing smoke. But Heidi mentioned something that the chief in Woodstock mentioned also, that there are other types of fires that are kind of sneaky and in the ground.
Sure. Yeah, you could probably break down most of the fires into three primary groups. The most common is a surface fire. That's when the fire is spreading through the surface fuels like leaves, pine needles, branches, small shrubs, grass, the types of dry fuel you find in any forest as you walk through. You can also occasionally get up into the treetops. These are fairly uncommon in New Hampshire, and they occur with coniferous trees where you have pine needles and things like that, needles, spruce, fir.
Dry and pine that, needles make it, a nice igniter for the fire.
Yeah, so you can have a surface fire, but then it spreads up into the treetops, and the fire can actually spread from tree crown to tree crown, and that's called a crown fire. Those are unusual, but they're quite spectacular when they occur and very dangerous to try to fight. The third primary type of fire is a ground fire, which is what Chief McKay and Heidi were talking about. And that's when we have this duff layer. It's kind of in between mineral soil and the surface fuels. It's decaying branches and leaves and things. It's an organic material. And when that dries out, that can sit there and smolder for days, weeks, and in some cases, when you get into like peat and things, it can actually smolder for months. And so those are kind of the three types. We saw all three types of fires on the Dilley Cliffs, the spectacular crown fires running up the slopes. We had the surface fire in the hardwoods. And then, of course, for the last 3 weeks, we've been dealing with ground fire.
That's what made it so persistent and
yes.
So hard to put out. So
yeah.
That's been interesting. And the chief told us, and you seem to be confirming it, Brad, that these duff fires, you know, can smolder for weeks, if not months. Just kind of down in there in the organic matter.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, it's not the spectacular flames like you see on television, but it is probably some of the most labor-intensive work because it just sits there in these crevices. It can burn down in roots. And really the only way to extinguish it is to dig it out, and sometimes it takes snowfall like we're seeing on the Dilley Cliffs fire.
Interesting. So again, it isn't just a matter of running in there with the fire hoses or dropping fire retardant from a helicopter. You physically have to hike up there and then get out your shovels or whatever and dig into these things and break it up.
Yep, that's correct.
You know, Heidi also talked, Will, about predictions for drought in the future. And yet the climate scientists at UNH tell us that overall, New England's going to have a wetter future. I think I've seen 20% wetter in the next, in the coming decades. So help us figure that out, Will. It's going to be drier, but it's going to be wetter?
Yes, a lot of the climate impacts from the changes we're seeing are counterintuitive. And in fact, it can be wetter and drier. And in fact, as a small example, I live up in Holderness, and we have this pond in the backyard. In the last couple of years, the pond has totally dried out. I've lived there for 29 years, and it's only done that two or three times. And so that tells you something, that there's something going on. Interestingly, up in Lost River back, I think it was 2011 when Hurricane Irene came through, there were these rainstorms that had sheets of rain where they got like 8 or 10 inches of rain in the period of an hour or two. And the gorge flooded, you know, and I've never seen that in before. But what's happening is that these sort of wilder extremes are occurring. And, you know, you can get two or three months of dry, and then you can get 2 or 3 hours of wet. And it's just, you know, for people who've lived in New Hampshire a long time, I think we're used to a more gradual change in our weather and climate patterns. And what we're seeing, I think, is something very different than what we would have observed 30 years ago.
And how is that dramatic weather, Will, and Heidi, you should jump in on this too. How is that stressful for trees?
Well, if you're a tree and you're used to having a certain dosage of water over a certain period of time, and all of a sudden you get a heavy dosage for a very short period of time and no dosage for a long period of time, that changes the things that make trees grow. And Heidi can probably describe this better than me, but we're seeing some dramatic changes. And everything from the frequency of seeding of some of the hardwood trees. And there's a lot of things going on right now that when we have foresters out in the woods, that they're telling us things that they've not seen before.
Extreme drought, extreme rain. How is that stressful for the trees that you study, Heidi?
Yeah, so we generally think of different plant species being adapted to acquiring three major resources: light, water, and nutrients. And here in New England, the limiting resources are generally light, because you have a lot of vegetation, and so trees need to grow tall to be able to access light, and also nutrients from the soil, but not water. Usually we have plentiful water, and so trees are not used to, they don't have strategies to survive periods of moisture stress. So I think because our trees are not adapted to drought, we could see that with more frequent drought. We don't really know how trees will respond, but we can certainly hypothesize that they will be more more sensitive to drought than, for example, many of the Western ecosystems.
Yeah, and again, if you've ever traveled out west, the trees are different, and partly that's because there are different species that are adapted to those long, long periods of dry weather that they have in that area. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email. We're taking your questions and comments about wildfires here in New Hampshire and elsewhere. 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Alex in Conway, who says, in the past months, the U.S. and its territories have experienced a variety of disasters. Hurricanes are a force of nature beyond our control. By contrast, the hazard of wildfires can be largely mitigated through proper preventative measures. To call hurricanes and wildfires natural disasters is a false equivalency, as fires are a preventable disaster. Alex says prevention has been increasingly neglected, and as a result, resources are pulled from local federal budgets to pay for massive Western wildfires. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Alex, you raised two important points, so I'm glad you sent the email. First of all, to you, I think, Brad, how often are wildfires an act of nature, and how often are they, you know, a cigarette, a campfire?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it really is dependent on where you are in the country. Here in New Hampshire, lightning fires are infrequent, pretty much less than 5%. If you look at an average, less than 5% of our fires are caused by lightning, because most of the time when we have lightning in New Hampshire, it's associated with rainfall. A lot of the fires out west are caused by lightning. They have a phenomenon called dry lightning, where the rain actually evaporates before it hits the ground, but of course the lightning does hit the ground. And so those types of fires are hard to prevent.
So that is a natural disaster.
Yeah. He's right that in New Hampshire, with 95% of our wildfires being caused by humans, if they're being caused by humans, then they can be prevented. But it's also correct that, we see year after year nationwide, we've been seeing what we call, record years. It seems like every other year we're breaking a new record with the amount of acreage burned and the number of firefighting resources required and the cost of fighting fire. This year, the Forest Service has already spent over $2.4 billion, which is over 55% of their total budget. And so what happens is they're spending so much money suppressing these fires that they're having to take money away from those things that could prevent the fire, such as, prevention programs or mitigation programs, such as thinning and trying to put defensible space around structures and those types of things. So it's kind of this spiral that we're in, where we're putting so many resources towards suppression, we don't have the resources for the things that could be helping prevent or mitigate those fires.
Well, so that's another point that Alex makes in his email. And thank you, Alex. And there is a lot out there now on sort of becoming a a fire-wise homeowner or a fire-wise community, in addition to some of the preventative measures that you talk about. What do you think about that, Will? What does it mean to be sort of fire-wise as a community?
Well, some of it's just common sense, and I think the State Division of Forests and Lands does a great job, and the Forest Service does a great job of putting signage and information out about the low, moderate, high potential for fire. And some of it is totally avoidable just by, you know, common sense behavior on the part of people. You know, the other piece of this is that long before we were here, fire was a really important ingredient of the evolution of what the vegetation that Heidi was talking about. So it's, you know, there was a great debate a number of years ago now about whether the Forest Service and the Park Service should allow fires to burn, like out places like out in Yellowstone National Park. And because they are a part of the natural course of things. And fortunately, we don't have to worry about those kinds of things in New Hampshire too frequently. But you know, we have to remember that the landscapes that we look at, and particularly in the Midwest and South and Far West, are in no small part creatures of fire, natural fire.
And we don't like to see that, though.
We don't. And our instinct is to try and fight the fire. You know, they're well, you know, we're very glad that the fire team fought the fire the way they did up in North Woodstock, because it didn't actually touch any of the Lost River Gorge property. So we'll open normally next spring. But, you know, one of the things that we are immediately our reaction was, oh, you've got to put that fire out. Well, if Lost River Gorge hadn't been there and there hadn't been any developed roadside attractions nearby, one of the strategies that Brad and Joe Koloski was on earlier may have adopted in fighting the fires, just let it burn out.
Controlled burns. And yeah, we'll talk in a minute about their ecological benefits. Go ahead, Heidi. You want to jump in?
I just wanted to follow up on some of Will's comments and just say that in some regions of the U.S., an important tool for either preventing or mitigating fire is to use prescribed fire, and especially in, for example, the West, trying to reduce the fuel load using prescribed fire so that when fires do occur, which they will eventually, they won't be as severe. But of course, there's a lot of resistance to using prescribed fire, and it's a lot of debate around that. Certainly, homeowners are resistant because of the possibility that the fire might escape.
Right. So prescribed burns, basically, correct me if I'm wrong, Heidi, basically that's where you on purpose burn a certain part of the landscape. You burn the dry scrubby brush or the dry lower branches so that it doesn't go, you know, poof in a big way later on. But it's politically difficult, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. Certainly in the wildland urban interface where you have the potential for fires to escape and affect homes and buildings, that is a much more challenging approach.
Well, people don't like it. You know, Will didn't want his Lost River Gorge area to be harmed, and nobody wants their home to be harmed. Do we use prescribed burns here, Brad, in New Hampshire?
Yes.
Seems more like a Western thing.
No, actually we do. And New Hampshire is the first state in New England to actually create a prescribed fire council. And this is made up of various different organizations, including the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests, University of New Hampshire, among many other different organizations. We get together and we talk about the use of prescribed fire. As was mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of our forests, being northern hardwoods and things, are not really fire adapted or fire dependent. But we do have these pockets of forests, such as the pitch pine barrens and some of the oaks and the pines, that are fire adapted. And in those areas, if we don't periodically put in fire, we lose that type of ecosystem. And those are important ecosystems. So we burn in those areas not just for fuel reduction, but also for ecosystem and wildlife habitat and those types of things. So, you know, we're never going to be on the large scale that you see in some of the southern states or some of the western states, but we prescribe burn several hundred acres a year here in New Hampshire.
Go ahead, Heidi.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that. I mentioned earlier that in areas where we see more oaks and pines in New England today, those are areas that in the past, in the 1800s, even pre-settlement, had experienced more frequent fire. So in forestry, one of the tools that we use to regenerate oaks and pines in particular is to use prescribed fire. But it's been very challenging to even successfully create a prescribed fire in the last century, just because of the wet conditions here. But we may find in the future more use of prescribed fire in forestry. We don't see a lot of regeneration of red oak in particular today. And so one of the kind of theories is that if we can start to introduce fire, maybe we can actually be more successful at regenerating the oak.
Because it's worth saying that the red oak is one of those species, right, Heidi, that regenerates after a fire. Something about the way the pine cones. You're gonna have to explain that to me.
No, that wouldn't be red oak. That would be the peach pine has serotonous cones that actually require fire to open.
Okay.
Red oak can sprout after fire, or red oak and white pine oftentimes regenerate together. Red oak in the understory.
That's it.
And then gets released.
I was getting mixed up. Right. I know, but it's counterintuitive for folks. But well, there are some species, as Heidi's explaining, that want a fire, that after a fire say, hooray, now I can reproduce.
Yes, and as Brad was describing, up in the Ossipee area, we actually own quite a bit of land in the Ossipee Pine Barrens, as does the Nature Conservancy. And we've teamed up with the Nature Conservancy and with Brad's shop to conduct prescribed burns to regenerate the habitat for the trees that Brad was talking about, the pitch pine and scrub oak. And it turns out that those habitats are also really important for certain species of moths and songbirds and other critters and flora and fauna. And so there's an ecological purpose for it.
Let's take a call. And Linda is in Peterborough. Hi, Linda. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah. I was out west this summer in Wyoming, Montana, Idaho for several months. And end of August, early September is when I got affected from the fires, mostly from Montana, that were blowing into Idaho. And it was really scary for maybe a week or so. It was hazardous air. The sun couldn't get through in the mornings. It couldn't get through that smoke. And then I happened to listen to a talk show in Idaho, and they had a Democrat and a Republican on. And I thought, isn't it interesting, the two views? The Republican was saying that the reason we have the fires is because of bad forest practices and management over the years, and that's why we're getting these big fires. The Democrat said it's climate change. We need to change our ways. We need to get a program to fight climate change. So I thought that was interesting, and I'm curious what your speakers had to say about that. And then the second thing, it is interesting with all these fires. As I was driving out there, you see so many homes that are built. I call them the McMansions. Down these canyons, there's only one way out, and you've got houses all along, and then up on mountaintops with their 1 mile long driveway. And I sit and think, okay, when a fire comes through, who's paying for it? How do people deal with housing in areas it seems to me they shouldn't be in?
Well, Linda, lots of important points, and this comes up a lot after floods, right? People say, you know, why we keep rebuilding homes that are on this river delta. But she's right. Brad, I'm going to turn to you first. As more development homes moves closer into wildlands, meaning the forest edge or the field edge, there are concerns about should you really build there?
Yeah, well, she brings up several very good points, and this is something that on a national scale we've been trying to deal with for years. People are very reluctant. They want to be out in the woods. They want to be out in that wilderness experience. You know, we actually see neighborhoods and homeowners associations that have ordinances that prevent tree cutting because they don't want you to be able to see houses from, you know, each other and those types of things. And it's really no surprise, as sad as it is and as shocking as it is, it's no surprise to people who've been in this business for a while to see when we have these fires, to see all this structure loss. Because there are some simple things that can be done, as Will was mentioning earlier, to protect homes.
All right. We'll pick that up after a short break, because I know there's some interesting research again about being a fire-wise homeowner and community development and so forth. Linda, thank you so much for calling. You can join us too, 1-800-892-6477. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at forest fires, given a persistent, stubborn fire in the White Mountains here in New Hampshire, and of course, the news from devastating fires out in California. We're looking at evolving views around protection and prevention, also hearing some predictions about wildfires in our future. Let's get your questions and comments in 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook and Twitter, it's NHPR Exchange. So, Brad, just before the break, we were talking about some of the issues raised by a call from Linda, who talked about, you know, homes being built in areas where you know eventually it's going to go up in flames. So you were talking about how development needs to be smarter about this. So go ahead.
Yeah, there's several programs. It's really not that difficult to try to make defensible space around your home. You know, there's different types of plants you can plant that are less conducive to fire. You know, keeping your gutters clean. Don't stack firewood right next to your house. Using more fire-resistant materials like stucco and brick and those types of things versus wood. It's starting to catch on in certain parts of the West, and one of the reasons is insurance companies are actually starting to get involved now. And if you're in a fire-prone area and you don't take any precautions to protect your house, you may be dropped by your insurance company. And that's really, I think, what it's going to take for some folks is they need that impetus to try to get them to make defensible space. The other thing I wanted to comment that Linda had mentioned was about she heard kind of two differing viewpoints. One was saying the reason was climate change. The other one was saying a lack of management. I would say they're both correct. You know, with climate change, we're seeing hotter and drier periods, particularly out west. We saw the enormous drought that California was in for multiple years. And so that is an issue, and we are seeing extended fire seasons. You know, I work with my colleague in Alaska, and he tells me how just in his career, the fire season in Alaska has gotten so much longer, and they're having fires during times of years before it was winter. And so that certainly is an issue. But because of that, I think making sure we manage the forest properly to try to thin around those areas that are very fire conducive, you know, that's part of the issue is if you have a large land ownership and they take no management activities on that, and then that abuts private land that's developed, well, you're not going to be able to stop that fire when it starts on that land that's not managed and comes off. And that's part of the issue. So I think both of them are correct. We do need more management. We do need more time spent on mitigating and managing some of those areas, particularly that are next to these build-up areas.
So some of those prescribed burns that Heidi described earlier, more use of that, better
correct.
Forestry practices might
correct.
Help because we are going to see an increased threat with drier and hotter
correct.
Weather. You know, it's interesting, Will, to hear Brad talk about, you know, homeowners and neighborhood associations and how they need to be smarter and more firewise, and how insurance companies out west anyway will say, you know, no, I'm not going to insure your home unless you're smarter about this. Are we going to see that in this part of the country?
You never want to say never, Laura, but it's probably not as direct a threat here as it is elsewhere for reasons we were talking about
sure,
earlier.
Sure, it's just wetter here.
But, you know, one of the things that that Brad was talking about that I think is worth pursuing in terms of those of us who are in the forest management business and land ownership business, you know, we need markets for the wood that we're growing. And, you know, forests are more than just timber resources. But and one of the interesting challenges that we're facing right now is that markets for low-grade wood, which is like 60-70% of what grows in the forest, are tanking. And so to the extent, as Brad was talking about, to the extent that good forestry, sustainable forest management yields forests that are more resistant to fires, we should be thinking about what are the markets that we can create to make it possible for good forest management to continue. And it's not going to be the most direct firefighting strategy, but it is a strategy. And one of the challenges for us in this community now is to try and figure out what markets do we see in the future for low-grade wood, you know, The saw logs that we're cutting and white pine and red oak right now are wonderful. Those markets are very healthy. So it's to the extent that thinning and, as Brad was saying, and managing the forest like that are helpful to reducing the threat of fire, then, you know, management is a strategy.
Well, it's interesting, though. Heidi talked earlier about how people don't like to see prescribed burns, and you talked about it too, Will. Management means cutting, and sometimes people don't like to see cutting either. They say, oh, you're cutting down the pretty trees. They don't see it as a forest fire management strategy that will actually improve the health of the forest.
Well, the good news is that there's enough trees in New Hampshire where we can do both. You know, we can protect the scenic areas that those pretty trees grow, and we can also manage sustainably forests all over the state.
Let's take another call, and this is Dick in Concord. Hi, Dick. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, hello, Will. I spent a time 20 years ago using sheep as a way of controlling vegetation, and prescribed grazing is another way of reducing the understory in forests with less of the perceived risk of prescribed burns. And I worked extensively at that time with the Forest Service, both in Florida and in New Mexico, trying to get contracts to graze the wildland urban interface. But at that time, there was quite a bit of resistance to the concept. But I tell you, we did graze transmission lines here.
Right.
In New Hampshire,
I've seen that happening. Right.
Vegetation control.
Well,
we did
Dick,
that for 6 years.
We talked about prescribed burns. What about prescribed grazes? Heidi or Brad?
Well, one thing I would say is I do know that is used on in some areas. I believe it was Colorado last year. I read about an area where they use goats and things to basically they graze them. They have like a portable fence that they move around this neighborhood, and they keep the grass and the brush down around the neighborhood as a fire
I've
defense.
Seen them around the power lines, and they say goats will eat anything. So maybe if people throw trash out the window, they'll eat the trash too while they're at it. What do you think, Heidi?
Yeah, it's an interesting comment, and I just wanted to bring up something that's related, and that is that here in New England, we're seeing an increasing demand for local products, especially agricultural products. And this, and there's been kind of a movement to try to increase the amount of total food that New Englanders and people from New Hampshire actually get from local agricultural production. And so, most likely, what we will see in the future is the need to convert forests to agriculture to increase the amount of agricultural production, because we have a limited area currently in agriculture. So one of the things that we're looking at the University of New Hampshire is managing what we call silvopasture for could be for dairy, it could be for combining that with timber. So essentially combining animals and trees on the same piece of land. I hadn't thought of it from the perspective of controlling for fire, but it's an interesting idea because you are reducing the total amount of tree cover, so you don't have continuous canopies that will burn.
Jumping from one
exactly,
canopy to another,
and then the grazing keeps down the grass. But then you're also addressing the issue of expanding and converting forest to agriculture, which is also there can be resistance to that because here in New Hampshire we like our trees, and so we don't want to see all the forests converted to agriculture. So silvopasture offers kind of an intermediate form of managing for agriculture production but still maintaining trees and landscape.
So, Dick, there you go. That's exactly what you're talking about, Heidi. Thank you for the call, Dick. Here's an email that came in from Grace, who says, it can happen here in New England. Ice storms leave fallen limbs and trees that add fuel and increase potential fire danger. Thank you, Grace, for the email. What about that, Will Abbott, the idea that after a big ice storm or windstorm, there is a lot of sort of, you know, tree junk on the ground, and it needs to be cleared out or it turns into tinder?
Yeah, definitely a potential problem. I think in the case of the Dilley Cliff Fire, one of the firefighting strategies they used was to actually burn the remaining fuel that was on the hillside and to prevent, you know, an eruption of the fire later on. So, yeah, the presence of fuel is a problem. And, you know, as Brad was describing earlier, the three different kinds of fire, they're there's a lot of fuel out in New Hampshire woods. And the challenge is we've sort of taken for granted that we don't have, with all the moisture we have, that we don't have a prevalence of fire. But I think the Grace's point is a good one. And I don't know that there's a prescription that, you know, one prescription for all circumstances. But to the extent that you're a landowner and you manage your land, presumably, and we do this in our lands, you know, you clean up after things like that. In some cases, we leave it be.
How do you know when to leave it be and when to clean it up? Because I hear what you're saying. You can't count on the fact that, you know, that sticks and branches and so forth that are left on the ground after a big storm. You can't count on that being wet anymore. It might provide nice fuel for a fire.
Well, and there are some on our lands where the Forest Society is actually the third largest landowner in the state, private landowner in the state of New Hampshire. And we have about 20% of our land is designated as what we call ecological reserves. So when you have a blowdown in an ecological reserve, we tend to let it be and let nature take its course. If we have a blowdown in an area where, you know, there's merchantable timber, we may go in and do a salvage cut to at least get what we can out of what got blown down and clean up what got blown down.
So it depends on what the land is for.
Correct. And what the, you know, what the natural communities are that are on the ground.
Go ahead, Brad.
Well, I was just going to say to Grace's point is if you look historically at some of the large fires we've had in New Hampshire, oftentimes they do come after some type of event, whether a man-made event like the logging that occurred in the White Mountains in the late 1800s, early 1900s, or a large natural disaster such as the 38 hurricane. The largest fire we have on record in New Hampshire occurred in the Marlow-Stoddard area. It was over 20,000 acres in 1941, and it was in the area where we had a lot of down timber from the 38 hurricane. So that's absolutely correct. When we have these abnormal fuel buildups from natural events, that can certainly, if we have all the right things in line, like a drought after a natural disaster that puts down a lot of fuel, if all those things line up, we can see significant fire.
Well, Grace, thank you for the email. Heidi, did you want to jump in on that too?
Yeah, I'll just add quickly that with climate change, we do expect to see more of these extreme events. So ice storms in particular, and hurricanes and droughts, and all of those do contribute to more dead fuel, and that dead biomass dries out faster when we do have dry periods, and so it just increases the risk of fire. So in response to you were asking earlier, how do we decide where and when to remove this dead fuel? And certainly focusing on the wildland-urban interface and that kind of border between where we have houses and where we have wildland areas might be a good area to target for treating that fuel.
So if you're going to start somewhere, start at that what's called the wildland-urban interface. There's a lot of talk about this now on the internet, you know, making that area a little more fire smart. So that's a place to start. So here's an email that came in from Adam in Sandwich, and this is very thoughtful. I want to read the whole thing. Adam says, I was on a hotshot crew in 2000 based out of New Mexico. It was the biggest fire season to date, but there have been several worse since. Adam says, I hate to be a cynic, but frankly, all of the discussion about wildland urban interface, housing materials, defensible space, prudent planning, preventative maintenance were all happening two decades ago. And Adam says, yet it seems like nothing has changed and we keep having the same discussion. Adam says, I'd like to think we could implement this wisdom that we've developed, but it makes me pessimistic when these tragic seasons not only keep recurring, but worsen. Climate change won't help them either. Adam asks, how can we make this stick? Adam, great to hear from you. Great question. Brad, I'm going to pick on you first. It's a big, tough question that Adam asks, but a good one.
Yeah, I wish I had the answer. I guess the first thing I would say is it took us a long time to get into this situation. You know, if you look back at the history of fire suppression in the U.S., you know, 1910 was kind of a pivotal year out west. We burned millions of acres, and the Forest Service set up a policy that, you know, it was absolute fire suppression. And we were in that mode for decades. And, you know, and I think in large part we thought we can put out fires. You know, we'll get to it. We'll put it out.
All fires are bad, and we're going to put all of them out.
Right.
Smokey the Bear.
And you know, what we've seen is there's some fires we just can't put out. There's nothing we can do about them. And we also have this fuel buildup, particularly in some of those southern and western forests. And so it took us many decades to get into this problem. It's going to take us many decades to get out of this problem. I was very happy to see Congress back in 2009, they passed the Flame Act. And one of the things that came out of that Flame Act was the National Cohesive Wildland Fire Management Strategy. And it basically has three tenets. And it is resilient landscapes, getting landscapes back, using prescribed fire management, those types of things. So you can still have fire on the landscape, but it's not this huge catastrophic, you know, fire that devastates everything. Community protection, making defensible space around our communities, and then also fire response. Those are the three tenets. You know, we've been starting to implement that on a national scale, but it's going to take a long time to get there. There's a lot of houses that were built, a lot of things that were done over the past years, and before we get to all those things, we're going to see more catastrophic fires. So it's a long-term problem.
Are you as pessimistic as Adam is? We keep having the same conversation, and he doesn't seem to think it's going to get better.
Well, I guess it depends on your time frame. Short term, I don't see a lot of changes. But what I do see short term is we can implement policies and things. You know, when new neighborhoods are built, when new homes are built, when they go into these areas in California where whole neighborhoods burn down, don't do the same thing you did last time, because those plants are going to grow back and they're going to burn again. So use these examples to try to change things in the future. So long term, I'm optimistic. Short term, I think we're going to see a lot more catastrophic incidents.
How about you, Will?
I'm generally an optimist, but I have to say that I think Adam raises some really good points. I'm frankly more concerned about the bigger picture of climate change and more pessimistic about that than I am about fire at this point.
Well, I want to close out with an email from Anna in North Conway, who says, I want to note for all the girls out there who might be interested in being a wildland firefighter that there were women fighting the Dilley Fire representing at least the New Hampshire National Guard and the White Mountain National Forest. Anna says, I mean no disrespect to the fire chief, but he repeatedly only mentioned the guys out there putting the fire out. So Anna wants to give a shout out for all the women firefighters. Thank you all very much for coming in. There's a lot more we could have talked about. And Heidi, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Heidi Asbjornsen, she's an associate professor of ecology at UNH. And Will, good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Will Abbott, he's vice president for policy and stewardship at the Forest Society. And Brad, thank you so much also.
Thank you.
Brad Simpkins, he's state forester and director of the New Hampshire Division of Forest and Lands. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.